get started. I'm not the ideal session chair because I'm sick, so I'm not that loud, but I'll do what worked pretty well of standing up a minute before and sort of encouraging people to wrap up. You got 10 minutes each, I guess, so this is our foundation session. And I guess we'll start with Terrence Taylor.
Okay.
Sounds good. And then as soon as we've rebooted it.
Well, they just shut down.
It was saying it was installing important updates.
Okay.
You don't want to be one of those people who didn't patch.
It looks as though it might wake up again, but I'll start because I know I remember the injunction from yesterday. This is part of my 10 minutes, so I better get going. And so I'm Terry Taylor. I'm from the International Council for the Life Sciences, in a non-profit based in Washington, D.C., but also I work with the Nuclear Threat Initiative, also based in Washington, D.C., but I do the global health programs for them. My background is largely a professional background and not an academic background. I spent some time in academia, but not too much. And so I've been mainly involved in military security policy, and I was in the Army for a long time. But thinking about risks, and in my case, I tend to think about it as living with risks rather than trying to eliminate all risks and try to avoid terms like risk management. If you could fantasize somehow, you could manage all the risks. So to come at it from a different direction. And with a colleague I met, a marine biologist, Raphael Sagarin, who's now at the Nicholas Institute at Duke University, a marine biologist. And we came together by accident, and we found that we were thinking about risk in a similar way, about living with risk. And he, being a biologist, was thinking about it in terms of what we could learn from biological evolution, that the history of that's 3.5 billion years of biological evolution, of which, by the way, we have to remember that humans were only in our current form only around 0.04% of that time. So we have to look back and see what we can learn, at least we thought, from that longer period of time. And not in terms of biomimicry, that's not what we're thinking about. I think that's a danger in thinking about looking at biological evolution and seeing what you can learn from it. There are certainly very important lessons, as Dominic Johnson pointed out yesterday, who was a chapter author in our book, that you can certainly, there are certain elements there, like in submarine design and various other areas, you can think where there's been direct mimicry. But we were thinking about it more in a conceptual sense. What can we learn in a conceptual sense? And so we gathered together about 14 or 15 people and had 3 meetings. They were a multidisciplinary group, a mixture of biologists, policy people, social scientists. And I have to say, why I'm particularly delighted to have the opportunity to join this group, what we lacked were people from the information technology sector. So that was, although there were systems, there's a systems technologist with us, but we do lack information technology, internet expertise, and these kind of things that I was listening to with great fascination yesterday. And I have to say that the book we produced, Natural Security, here. I'll do a bit of advertisement, but I can't in a few minutes really cover the ground. Thank you very much. That's where we're supposed to be. And I've only got one slide I really want to use in a minute. I can't do justice to all their different views, so I'm just going to talk in very, very broad terms about the lessons that we drew overall from our work. I think the principal lesson overall is that if you look back at successful species, either individually or as a group, They did not survive and be successful by eliminating all the potentially catastrophic risks that were coming at them from their environment. Not that perhaps in terms of organisms they could carry out a risk analysis or somehow work it out of it in an intellectual sense as the human species might do. But it's very, very, very clear, and it's a stark lesson that comes out, that adaptation, if I may state the obvious, is the order of the day, and is very much the methodology by which these species survive. And an important thing is be successful. It's not just that there's an interpretation of Charles Darwin's remarks about a book, we're now in the 150th year of its of the publication of the greatest idea, scientific idea of all time, I would say, so my colleagues would also say. Survival of the fittest is not, is an oversimplistic interpretation of that book, it's much more subtle than that. But the key is adaptation to a range of risks, which means probably co-adaptation of other species alongside that might potentially be risks and so on. And I think there are lessons in a conceptual sense, and we think about our society, global society in that sense, which is transforming and evolving immensely rapidly. And you can look at political examples. Someone, I think, yesterday mentioned the collapse of the Soviet Union, if you think about that. And you could say, well, that was a failure to adapt. But I think, actually, on the contrary, it's an example of adaptation. And the core of the Soviet state, the Russian Federation, is in a different configuration now, and adapted through a cathartic experience and certain decisions by leadership, opportunistic risk takers took over control, and now we have a different, in that geographic space that used to be filled by the Soviet Union, we have a different organism, if you would think of it, an organism, which is adapted, co-opted, various things, and is surviving pretty well, as it is at the moment. So I think we just need to think about, if you think about collapse of a state, you have to remember that it's probably adaptation. There are other examples, and if you look at the work by, some of you have, I'm sure, Jared Diamond, his later work, Collapse. And then he picks these isolated states, like, well, areas of geographic areas, for example, Greenland, the Norse in Greenland, who failed to adapt their farming methods to a climatic change where it became much, much colder. And they were not able, through their pastoral methods, they didn't adapt them. Yet living alongside them were the Inuit who did adapt and were able to continue surviving. They collapsed and society disappeared. And his other example is Easter Island, where they denuded their vegetation to the extent that the society was just not able to survive. But these were very isolated places, both at a particular time, of course, in the Norse example in Greenland, and Easter Island in a geographic sense, totally isolated, in a particular situation where they were not able to actually adapt to other forms of sustenance. Fishing was particularly poor in that area and so on, so they were not able to adapt, or they perceived they were not able to adapt. And that society collapsed. But I think in the interconnected world we're living in now, what we're seeing is adaptation and change. I was very interested yesterday to hear about perceptions of risk and perhaps about individuals and maybe even groups. The message, the lesson we take from our book that, let me put it in perhaps an entertaining way, risk is good. Risk is essential for survival and understanding risk, because it's the risk takers who can adapt and change society and move them on into a different and more successful time, and perhaps counter the risks that they face, a potentially catastrophic risk. So I would like to just put the idea that risk is good. Risk takers are very good for our societies, and they are the drivers of change. You can challenge that if you like. And in the few minutes I've got, I can't really explain the background to that. But let me just try and give just one example. Yeah, that's all I can do. And here we have, because I have a biological background, in addition to my military background, just think about the biological risk spectrum. look along that spectrum from the left, sorry if you can't read it, or on the left-hand end, naturally occurring risks, catastrophic ones potentially, which there's something in the air about that now with the H1N1 swine flu outbreak, people thinking about potentially another 1918 influenza pandemic, whereas yesterday it was declared a pandemic, the H1N1, by the World Health Organization. And then as you move along the spectrum, there are re-emerging infectious diseases. One of the biggest threats is tuberculosis, multi-drug resistant TB, and even XDR TB, which is becoming rampant in certain societies, even in Russia. And we haven't got an answer. So don't imagine there are answers to this. There isn't an answer. Antibiotic resistance is a huge, huge problem. And if we don't do something about it, a different risk of a pandemic, it's that creeping risk, slow. And there's a different response to that kind of risk, which I think is really interesting. And people touched on that yesterday. So you have a risk which accumulates over time very slowly. Climate change is another one. But just think about antibiotic resistance. I defy anyone who's got an answer to that. There's the unintended consequences of research, which, if you think there might be a catastrophic risk emerging from that, it's probably pretty remote. But it's possible that somebody may do something, manipulate an organism that's could somehow overwhelm at least part of the biosphere that we live in an important way. Lab accidents, which happen all the time. I have to say, mostly in developed countries, less so in developing countries. It's a difference in when you just look at the record, which is an interesting one. And then so we're moving, remember, now towards human interventions. So the human intervention gets bigger and bigger as we get towards the right of that spectrum. And then there is a lack of awareness about safety and security. And I think there was an interesting point yesterday. I think in this biological area, you have to think about biosafety and biosecurity together, not separately. And I think the real dangers in separating those and saying, this, what you do over here is security, what you do over here is safety, big mistake. So you have to think holistically along this whole spectrum. And then negligence and deliberate misuse, that somebody using an organism. And we mustn't get pathogen-centric, the technology, things like aerosol technology and so on, as a weapon. And as I get my last few minutes...
You're done.
I'm done, okay. just think on deliberate misuse, the impact of the anthrax attack in Washington, 5 people killed, and billions of dollars being spent on BioShield. And it's a failure to look along the spectrum and to assess the risk properly. Thank you very much.
Reminder that when I stand up, that means 1 minute left.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Okay, so I prepared some slides last night because there was so much that was said yesterday that made much of what I had earlier planned to discuss the most irrelevant. And so I have just a few kind of comments, but kind of view of cyberspace versus human space. And where we are in terms of security. Now, something which I guess we all know, but I think follows very clearly from the discussion yesterday, is that we have very extensive evidence. First of all, I guess we didn't talk too much about it. We cannot build secure systems. We have this huge record of bugs being kind of introduced anytime you have even a fairly small program, and when you build big systems, it's riddled with bugs. So we just simply cannot build large secure systems. Another one is that we cannot live with secure systems. And this was kind of underlying idea behind many of the observations, such as people have a certain fixed budget for security, in terms of time and effort, other things, and they're only willing to do so much. And the problem with secure systems is that, well, they enforce various formal rules rigidly, and people don't like to be bound by rigid rules. So as a result, we're kind of stuck with an unsolvable problem. Now, there's no silver bullet. We're not going to solve a problem through any wonderful sort of new insights. The most we can do is have a little bit nudge here and there, modify things a little bit, band-aids, chewing gum and baling wire, etc., keeping things running. But I think there's another point to just keep in mind. Namely, I think we have a lot of evidence now that people don't need secure systems. Look, I mean, people have been complaining about insecurity for decades. Right? And yet, you know, we live. And we actually live quite well. Cool. So I think that's a fairly convincing demonstration that we don't really need absolute security. And why is that? Okay, so I think there's a way to kind of view this situation, which might be a little bit helpful. And this goes back to a general puzzle. When you look at human society, okay, it's amazing that it functions. Well, first of all, that we still live. Okay. I mean, any one of you could pull out a gun and shoot me. Okay. Or explode a bomb and take out the whole room and the whole building, other kinds of things. Mostly it doesn't happen. Occasionally, something like that happens. So we live. But then also we somehow manage to live, we manage to get fed, and yet, I mean, there's a whole body of literature studying spreadsheets. And spreadsheets, of course, is how business and government run. Most of the planning is done using spreadsheets. And there's a wide body of literature documenting that just about any time you have a substantial, kind of reasonably large spreadsheet, it's flawed in some fundamental way. Some of the relations are either wrong. In other words, even if you manage to get correct data into the spreadsheet, what you get out is going to be flawed. And yet somehow we live. Okay? Somehow our groceries tend to be stuffed with food when we need it. There are occasionally pictures here and there. And there are many more things along these lines. Even when you think about PhD researchers and you look at their kind of peer-reviewed papers, clinical disciplines and other things, you discover a huge number of mistakes that somehow society manages to put up with that. Okay? So there are mechanisms by which human society persists, which I guess go back to some of the questions or points of the previous speaker about looking at biology, because biological systems are very kind of non-formal, they kind of obey some rules, but with lots of errors and lots of kind of imperfect error correction mechanisms, and it sort of somehow works. The main issue is adaptability and survivability. And human society seems to have done fairly well. Of course, maybe it's about to collapse too. Might be running out of fossil fuels, maybe we will be subject to runaway, you know, global warming, etc., but that's another issue. Now, so the problem with cyberspace is that it was first conceived by technologists. It was thought of as this wonderful new world, separate from the physical world, and also free from all of those nasty things, all those nasty human weaknesses, lawyers, legislators, things like that. And technologists could build things right. Okay. And in particular, we could compensate for the defects in human space. Okay. Well, that's not really what's happened. But the view is perhaps best exemplified by the famous Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace by John Perry Barlow from, was it 30 years ago, where he talks about cyberspace. It's arrayed like a standing wave in the wave of our communications, etc. Governments go away, that kind of stuff, which really seems naive today. It should have seemed naive even in those days. Okay. And the problem is, if you really had this separate world of cyberspace, all these standing waves, which really kind of were isolated in this beautiful world, then you would have serious problems. Because then if somebody manages to crack your RSA, modulus, they can become you, they can destroy all of you, okay? But in practice, that's not what happens. And the reason that we're not that vulnerable to somebody taking our personalities over is because cyberspace is not separate from the physical world. Okay? In fact, human space and cyberspace are very closely intertwined. And I think the real key point is that human space compensates for the defects of cyberspace. So the initial idea was we'd build this wonderful, pure cyberspace that would compensate for weaknesses in human space. What we've learned is we cannot build such a world. And second, what instead we're doing is just the opposite. We're using the protective mechanisms of the human world, human space, to compensate for the weaknesses in cyberspace. And you can sort of see it, how it happens. Think about voting, electronic voting. Wonderful new idea. thoroughly debunked. No, we cannot build secure voting schemes in that case. So what do? We kind of back them up with paper trails. We get some of the advantages of cyberspace. We do have electronic voting, which people love. It's kind of, human usability is greater. But we also get some security, some traceability by relying on the physical world. And there are many, many other things which you can view in the same space, bring in things that we already knew how to do in the old physical world to compensate for things that we're not able to do in cyberspace. And in particular, one, something to keep in mind is another cold dose of reality. Cyberspace does not matter that much. Yes, it's helpful, it simplifies things. You know, you can make reservations online, you can get, you know, Kindle downloading a book for you in a matter of minutes as opposed to having to travel to a bookstore and so on. But overall, it's just one additional thing that human society uses. And it's not all that reliant on. And again, something to keep in mind, nice example, 1980s was when kind of research and deployment of security systems skyrocketed. Was also the era when the fax became ubiquitous, including fax signatures. Very insecure by themselves, okay, but they worked, and they are very usable because they are tied into the whole tapestry of human interactions. Yes, you can forge a fax signature, very easy to do, but you typically cannot do much damage with it because the transaction that is certified by the fax is one of the whole tapestry of other kind of transactions. And it's not really all that easy to fool people and forge everything. And one of the problems, one of the saving graces, is the bad guys are also human. And they also make mistakes, and most of them are stupid. So I think the final couple of points is there are some contrarian lessons that one can draw from this approach. One is, again, something that was mentioned yesterday, we can draw a lot of lessons from the bad guys. Okay? I mean, they don't build clean systems. Viruses and worms and so on are not clean software programs. Okay? They're actually designed to be hard to reverse engineer. And I think, again, much of the emphasis, say, in software engineering on doing clean modular programs is misguided perspective. There are advantages in spaghetti code and other things. Okay? So thank you very much.
Dana? I decided to prevent any possible technology chaos by just not using slides, so work with me. For the last 4 years, I've been doing a bunch of ethnographic field work about how teenagers use social media. The link that you have on that page is a dissertation, therefore it is really long. I don't expect most of you to read it, but some of you might want to scan it for different things that are relevant to you. I'm going to talk about two case studies from what's going on and what I talked about there, because I think it's relevant based on what I heard yesterday. And then I'm going to back up and think about some of the bigger issues as we should think about it. So case study number one. Lies. I'm really interested in what information teenagers put online that is quote unquote inaccurate, right? So you have a profile by XOXO who says she's 95, is from Christmas Island, she makes $250,000, right? We know that this isn't entirely accurate. We know that, she lists that she's also from a particular school in New Jersey and is going to graduate in 2011. All of her friends happen to also be from New Jersey. So what's going on there? What is she putting up that information for? Well, first, there's a couple of common lies that are really critical to this. You should know that in most social media, there's a really overwhelming population from Afghanistan and Zimbabwe that uses all of these systems. Right? Why? That is the first and last of every list of the possible countries you could be from. So it's really fun to go and do that. People lie about their age. If you're a teenager, 69 is still really cool, right? The other thing is 61 or 71. Why? It's an inversion of 16 or 17 on systems that make you be 18 or older. But there's also something really funny about being 108 or being any random age. So I started asking teenagers about how they chose the ages. What I found really interesting in this is that it's not always necessarily obvious. Sure, there are teens who say they're 18 or 21 because that's fun. But there are also teens who move over to the scroll down thing and just scroll and randomly select, right? So they're 47. what the heck is cool about being 47? Right? The point is that they're not trying to be 47. They don't think that they're 47. They don't think that they're from Afghanistan or Zimbabwe. They want the system to think that. They know their friends will think that they're actually from where they're from. Right? So you get some really interesting trade-offs. Teenagers will not put the wrong birth date because they don't want them to get the inaccurate, you know, happy birthday. But they'll put the wrong birth year. $250,000, by the way, is just cool. So the big issue when you start to see why teenagers are doing this is some is simply to get access to the system. But more often than not, it has to do with their perceptions of safety. It has to do with their belief that they have to lie to be safe. Their parents, law enforcement, teachers have all told them that they have to lie to be safe. They started lying at the age of probably 8, 9, 10, when their parents wanted them to get an email address and they had to be 13 to get on there, right? COPPA has actually generated an entire generation of liars. Their parents encourage this because their parents want them to talk to the grandmother or talk to their friend, right? And so they've been lying from the beginning, and then they lie to be safe. They put inaccurate information thinking that will protect them. So as we've got this dichotomous issue, we have to think not just about what kind of inaccuracies we get because people are actually trying to deceive, but what happens when we've created a system where we think that this kind of things will protect us? Case study number two, password sharing. All right. So the last data that I can find that's publicly recorded on teenagers sharing their password is from Pew in 2001 that said 22% of teenagers share their passwords. Now, I don't know if you knew much about 2001, but the teenagers that were on there are very different than the teenagers that are there now. When I interview teenagers around this country, I find that almost every single one of them has shared their password with at least one person. The most obvious person is their parents. Parents actually tend to really enforce this. You will share your password, or at least password to one of the accounts, because again, we go back to this rhetoric of safety. But what I find really fascinating is the reasons in which they share them with other people. Teenagers often share their passwords primarily with their significant other when they begin dating, or with their best friend before that, right? Classic BFF protocol. The reason for this password sharing is about this narrative of trust. And it's something that will sound really familiar to many of you, right? If I don't share my password, somebody thinks I might have something to hide, right? It's a really common conception within these conversations of privacy. You know, it's like, oh, you've got to, you know, if you don't put something out there, if you're trying to have privacy, you're trying to hide something. Well, that has worked its way down into the teenage rhetoric about why they share their passwords. And they do it because it's a way of brokering trust. If I share my password with my significant other, I'm going to let him know, her know, that I actually trust her, him. Right? And that becomes a really critical negotiation. Of course, the funny part of that is that there's also a negotiation during the breakup of making certain that you change your password before you do the breakup. Right? Which is absolutely critical, because otherwise you're going to get yourself into a lot of trouble. But this password sharing becomes really, really tricky because, of course, it's the cornerstone of a lot of bullying and a lot of social dynamics when the average teenage dating lasts about a week and a half, and friends sort of have the sort of ups and downs as things go on. But password sharing has become part of the social protocol for an entire generation. So we have to think about what that means as we're thinking about different kinds of security. So finally, the sort of main conceptual ranting of all of this. You know, many of you are really deeply invested in security, and you take with you a lot of understandings about how the world should work, how people should operate, what they should care about. The fact of the matter is, one of the best things I get from teenagers is that your shoulds don't matter, right? They have their own set of rules of what makes sense because of the social configuration in which they live. Right? And if you look at social media, the ways in which young people are using it are fundamentally different than the ways that adults are using it. Right? Even if you look at the sort of Facebook meme of a couple of months ago of 25 things, I love the difference between the adults and the teenagers of this, and it has to do with conceptualized audiences. The adults seem to write 25 things that their high school friends should have known about that they haven't seen them for the last 10, 15, 20 years. The teenagers wrote 25 funny things that you should know about me now, i.e. what I'm doing at home that you don't know about. Right? Two totally different approaches to it. And part of it is that adults, when they go into these systems, they take with them a set of expectations and norms and values, and they inject that into the technology. For teenagers, they're growing up with this technology as just part of the everyday world, as part of what they're trying to learn, what they're trying to experience, how they're trying to make sense of a public at large. They're working through, and they're, you know, sort of manipulating the technology to get what they want done. And it often looks a lot different than what adults are doing. The thing is that teenagers are going to grow up, and they're not going to grow up to using it the way that you as an adult uses it. They're going to grow up to use it the way that they, based on a whole set of histories, will make sense of it as an adult. It won't be the same as what they're doing as a teenager, but it'll be different. So we can't think about security without getting into these models of how people actually think about privacy, how young people think about privacy, as we deal with it. And youth are working through the social norms, but the fact of the matter is privacy is not dead. Teenagers don't think this. You may look at what a teenager puts up online and think that they're putting up all sorts of information, but it's not working that way. They're taking actually a set of lessons from other people, very public people, celebrities, in fact. I love an article about Angelina Jolie, where she's quoted as saying that the reason that she puts so much information out to the public, to the press, is because it allows her to hide what is most important to her. Right? And I see teenagers doing similar things. They'll put tons of material up, but that's not the whole story, and that's part of the point. They're also starting to do things that I find fascinating that we've seen in censored regions for a long time. They will put all of this sort of information that you can read on one surface level, but if you know what's really going on, all of the in-jokes are in there in all sorts of different references. Sometimes in ways that this really backfires and is kind of embarrassing. My favorite moment was when Coca-Cola was all excited because their brand was being used all over MySpace. And I hate to break it to them, but that's not the Coke that's being referenced. So there's ways in which some of this is multi-language. There's ways in which some of this is sort of deeply contextualized. But the thing is that they're telling a story that actually has to do with the complicated ways in which they are living. The other thing to realize is that for teenagers, they haven't lived the same sort of privacy world that you've lived in. Many of them talk about the home as a not private place, a place where they have no control, no sense of what's going on. They have no way of actually saying who can go into their room, when somebody can go into the room. They're always in trouble for, you know, how the bed's not being made or things are a complete mess. And what you start to hear about what privacy means to teenagers is that privacy is fundamentally about a sense of control. And that becomes really interesting when you think about the ways in which we are moving away from a notion of bounded space as the control function that you can operate on and think about things more in terms of networks. So control in a social media context means controlling how the information flows, how far it will flow, what as it flows, what are the breaking points of how it will be understood. Right? Teenagers know really quickly that if they put certain kinds of things with certain kinds of twists up, it'll spread really far. Right? This is the old game of gossip. Right? You know that one person at school that you tell them that don't tell anybody this. Right? Guaranteed it will spread everywhere. The same thing is operating on social media, but knowing that as it spreads, the game of telephone will mean that what spreads is not necessarily what one can think. So what you're seeing is, I can't give you a clear picture of what's going on with privacy, but what I can tell you is that it's getting complicated, it's getting messy. There's all of these spokes in which things are sort of happening. I write much more detail in that long, painful dissertation that some of you may or may not want to read, but I really invite you to sort of step out of what you assume as adult norms and what privacy should be, and look at how people who are living these worlds in a very different environment are making sense of it. Thank you.
Okay, hello. My name's Mark Levine. I'm a social psychologist, and I'm going to tell you a social psychological story at a group level. We've heard some references to psychology kinds of stuff, but very little collective social psychology. And I'm going to try and persuade you, in the 10 minutes I've got, that the current zeitgeist that there is in society as a whole, but also in psychology in particular, that groups are somehow bad for us, is a mistake, or rather, half a story. When I say groups are bad for us, what I mean is this. There's a pervading tendency to see collectives or groups as a threat to psychological functioning. That somehow, when we're on our own, we act in a rational fashion, where we have controls which organise our behaviour and so on. When we get together with other people, somehow those things begin to be undermined. So you get stories like mob violence, mass hysteria, peer group influence, that kind of stuff. And social psychology works in the idea that what happens in collectives, and it's negative influence on the individual works in three ways. One is the presence of other people somehow weakens the controls which stop the violent atavistic impulses inside us from springing up. A second one is the presence of other people weakens our ability to resist the influence of others. So all the popular demagogues of the 20th century have used this idea to try and spread their influence. And the last of the triumvirate is one which says, when we're gathered with other people, we lose our sense of social responsibility. We get diffusion of responsibility. Other people will do it and not us. So everywhere you go, there's the story that somehow groups are bad for us, and we need to watch out for them. And we never really look at when groups might be good for us. And that's what I'm going to try and do. I'm going to try and persuade you that while that might be true, it's half a story. And the other half is the radically unexplored half. And I've been trying to do some work around violence and groups. And I'm going to try and persuade you that, contrary to what you might think, groups do intervene in a pro-social way in violence. And I'm going to try and tell you a story about why that intervention is sometimes successful and why it sometimes fails. And I'm going to do it with this. This is a CCTV control room in Britain. These men are watching public space cameras which survey almost every inch of public space in British towns and cities. Britain is, you probably know this, I'm sure, one of the most surveyed countries in the world. There are, these are contested figures a bit, but it gives you a flavour, 4.2 million of these cameras around, one for about every 14 people. Okay. In some places, it's estimated you can be on over 300 different camera systems every day. The British Home Office's own research suggests that these cameras do not do much good against things like violent crime. They're very good against things like car park crime and other kinds of minor infractions, but they don't really do what is advertised on the tin. Okay. And what I'm going to tell you about is research I've been doing, which doesn't look at any of these, the privacy or the security issues related to the cameras themselves. I've been using the cameras as a data resource. So I have camera operators who have been trained to follow incidents which they see spark for violence, potential. They then follow them through. And we've been collecting a corpus of these kinds of things within certain kinds of privacy and privacy constraints. And I'll tell you about those with this. This speaks to the advantages and the disadvantages of using this kind of data. The advantage is I've got real-life stuff. I can see it happening in real time. The disadvantage is I don't know anything about these people. I don't know about their interactions. I don't know anything about the history of the event. I have no sound. So it's a bit like doing primate research, except that I don't know anything about the troop or even the hierarchy inside it. All I've got is the actual behaviours that people are engaged in. And so that's what I've been coding. I'll talk through this stuff. I'm going to try and show you some of the clips, which is why I'm really glad that this works. So here you see what the data looks like, and I'll talk over it. This is pixelated, because I'm not allowed to show it to you completely clearly. It's much better quality than this. What we count up is we identify who the perpetrator is in these events, who the target or the victim is, who the bystanders are, how many there are, what the gender composition and so on is, and then what we also code for are the acts. So we look at escalating things, which are things like this, de-escalating stuff, which is things like this, or stepping between, and then we code the orientations of the acts. Who's doing what to whom? Perpetrator, aggressor towards target, bystander, de-escalator towards target, that kind of stuff. What I want you to see is how much intervention is actually going on. This is one of the classic things. People are constantly trying to intervene to stop things from kicking off. Okay, so I haven't got time to show you. I can show you the videos outside in full if you'd like to see them. But let me remind you what the headline story is from psychology for this. Traditional psychological approaches to this kind of stuff would say, as group size increases, so you get classic de-individuation stuff, you get more propensity for disordered behavior. Harder to monitor, people's atavistic impulses are let loose, so you should get a group size effect which leads to more antisocial escalatory stuff going on, one prediction. The other is, as group size gets bigger, you should get more diffusion of responsibility. You should get less people doing intervention stuff. It's not my responsibility. Someone else has to deal with this. Okay, so two interrelated predictions to do with the negative impact of groupiness. And so, what happens? Well, there is no significant increase in the antisocial escalatory stuff as groups get bigger. In fact, there's a significant increase of de-escalation. If you look at the escalation and de-escalation combined, what you get is, as group size increases, an increasing tendency of people to contribute de-escalation, pro-social stuff, social control. People are trying to bring this thing under control. They're trying to regulate it. Okay, rather than the classic story, which would suggest that it's like to get more and more out of control. Remember, these guys have all been drinking. I don't actually have objective data to show that, but you can be pretty sure that that's the case. So you might expect this inhibition leading to kind of atavistic stuff spilling out of them. You should expect really lots of deregulation. But in fact, what you get is, you could argue, some kind of release of the pro-social disposition amongst us to order and bring the group under some kind of normative control. Violence, I suggest, these kinds of things, is not normative. It is anti-normative. People are trying to stop folk inside them from behaving badly. But you do get lots of violence. So can I say anything about what kinds of interventions predict successful regulation and control versus unsuccessful? Can I show what works and what doesn't? So we tried then to look at the patterns of the sequences as they unfold. In about half our clips, they are regulated short of violence. It's brought under control. Low levels of violence sometimes. In the other half, it escalates and you get serious disorder. So we plot the patterns of sequences, starting with what happens when a perpetrator goes like this, something escalatory. What happens next? Is it a de-escalatory or an escalatory act? And then what follows from that? Is the next act de-escalatory or escalatory? And so on. And we build up these kind of probability trees to see if we can show a pattern of probabilities which may or may not be different from violent sequences and non-violent sequences. And I'll show you one of these little probability trees. You won't be able to make much sense of it from that distance. But what this shows is our analysis of the sequences which end in violence minus those which end short of violence. The little dot at the beginning is the first part of the sequence. Perpetrator does something aggressive. What happens next? Well, you can see that at the first turn of the sequence, it doesn't make any difference, doesn't predict the difference. It doesn't matter what happens immediately afterwards, at the first turn. It also doesn't matter what happens at the second turn in the sequence. That doesn't predict the difference. It's when you get to the third turn in the unfolding sequence that you begin to see differences in the pattern which predicts violence from non-violent outcome collectively. Now, I'm telling you about the acts and not the actors, but there's something about the third turn in the sequence which is important. Now, if you look at the animal research on third-party intervention, which and there is some, what it says is that in animal societies, third-party intervention is successful in societies where you get an uneven distribution of power, and power is located in a few powerful individuals. They can come in, everyone recognizes their ability, their right to intervene, they do so, and it's successful. In some animal societies where you get an even distribution of power, that third-party intervention tends to lead to disorder. So have I got a powerful individual in here going, stop it, stop it, stop it, and then it stops? Or is there something else going on? So we plotted out those patterns. And again, I'll show you another little graph. What you see at the bottom where it says 111, that's same person, same person, same person. And then you get 112, 121, 122. These are different combinations of pairs. And at the end you've got 123. That's one person, another person, and then a third person. And as you'll see, this is the fourth turn in the sequence. This is what happens after the three acts. If it's the same person all the time, the next turn in the sequence is more likely to be antisocial rather than pro-social. The ones in the middle, no preference. But it's when it's a collective coordination, a 1-2-3, where people are acting in concert together, you get pro-social outcomes over antisocial ones. And I will finish with my take-home slides. What I want to persuade you is groups can act pro-socially, they can act against violence, bring it under control, even though they may be disinhibited. Successful intervention, third-party policing, is a collective group-level accomplishment. To understand how to deal with this stuff, we need to know more than the individual characteristics of the perpetrator, the individual characteristics of the victim, or maybe something about the victim-perpetrator interrelationship. We need to understand the collective regulation of how these things are achieved. And so my contribution to the final session question, which was how do we fix the world, is the message I want you to take away with is, when you're thinking about these kinds of things, groups can be part of the solution and group processes rather than thinking about them as part of the problem. Okay.
I think our group would be interested in your work. Yeah. Yeah.
And see it start.
Yeah, well, I'd be very interested in that. Yeah. We've got a website. www.dominiumsecurity.org. Not many people are using it yet, but we got such a big interest in the book. It's a site for people to, you know, if they want to join. This book is... it's a process that's going on. Okay. This is the beginning, we think.
I'm Jeff Mackey Mason, at the University of Michigan. Economist, I dabble in computer science and psychology a bit. So security problems are incentive problems, is my primary assertion today. Basically, if we have bad guys, if we start with walls, the question is, how motivated are the bad guys to get through them? Bad guys can get through walls. They can get under walls. They can get around them. If we have bad guys, how motivated are the good guys to stop them? Fundamentally, it's a question of how much people want to cause harm or to secure. Awareness of that problem is just the first step. The second step, what I want to talk about today, is not just understanding that humans are part of the equation, but that humans are responsive devices. They're smart devices. And we can design with them. They can be part of our toolkit of design. So this is going in a slightly different direction. Rather than just saying, let's recognize humans are part of the problem, let's use them to help solve the problem in systematic ways. This isn't entirely new, of course. For example, we all understand that for passwords to work, we need to make them costly enough to crack that the bad guys don't find it worthwhile. It demotivates them. Sure, some may try, but a successful password system is one where they don't try hard enough because it's not worth it to them. So that's recognizing that there's a fundamental motivation to get in. It's only so strong. Let's make it more costly for them to get in than it's worth it. Some of the ways motivation comes into play is not always so obvious, I think. For example, Google bombing. It used to be a pretty big problem back in the late 90s, early 2000s, where people would try to get their activity on the top of the list of results to get attention to their product, for instance, or their business. Still happens, but it's getting to be a pretty big problem. Google took into account the motivations. One thing they did is they changed their algorithms to make it more costly, to make it harder to successfully get to the top and harder to stay there very long. So they raised the cost to demotivate people. But another thing Google did that was fairly clever is they lowered the relative benefits of being there by giving people an alternative, sponsored links. Now, rather than having to break the rules, the terms of use, and having to do the costly effort to Google bomb, and then having to repeat it a day later when they got rid of you, you could just pay to get your listing up there. So it gave them an alternative to accomplish what they wanted to accomplish in a pro-social way. So this is about design. It's not just about the economics of security or the psychology of security, on which there's been a lot of work in recent years. And we're starting to get some understanding. There's been some design work, but I think there's a lot more to be done, and that this is an emerging area with a lot of opportunity. It's something that's been happening more in other applications and information systems than in security. Just want to say a few words about how we can start thinking about doing that in security applications. If we're going to design the humans in the system, can we fall back on Knuth? Well, no. We can't program the humans in C. What are the languages and the control rules for the humans in the system? Humans' behavior is heuristic, not algorithmic, so we call on the sciences of motivated behavior. Systematic ways in which human behavior responds to certain types of contexts and incentives that we can predictably get them to behave in certain ways. Not all the time, but as Andrew pointed out, no system is perfectly secure, nor would we want it to be. It's usually not worth the cost. What we want is some improvement in security in some systematic, predictable way. So, for example, some of the sciences of motivated behavior we draw on. Individual rational choice theory, or microeconomics, where it's primarily practiced. Strategic rational choice theory, or game theory, crucial for security problems. Non-rational, but not irrational, choice in social context, or social psychology. And non-rational choice in internal context, self or psychodynamic psychology, personality psychology. Various theories and empirical bodies of evidence that have been developed over decades or more that give us systematic predictions about the way people will behave, or rather reliable predictions about systematic behaviors in response to motivations and incentives that we can use in designing systems. It's common, especially for those who do use C or Perl or whatever, to think that this is just guesswork, that we don't really know what people are going to do. But then again, we don't really know what bad guys are going to do either. In fact, they're the people we often care about in these settings. It isn't just guesswork. There is a large body of empirically supported research. It's also a rapidly growing area. The recent emergence that many of you are aware of behavioral economics is just one example, which has become basically a merger of economics and psychology, or certain parts of psychology, a very rapidly growing area where people are taking seriously problems like problems in information systems from the point of view of predictable behavior. So let me just give you a couple of quick examples. A typical problem for people in this audience is keeping the bad guys out. Signaling theory, from the theory of asymmetric information, offers us a canonical model for certain types of problems of keeping bad guys out. It provides, for instance, a very straightforward and highly predictive model of the way the password systems work and CAPTCHA systems work, and what conditions they need to satisfy in order to work well. Things such as the ratio of cost between breaking it and the good guys getting in. If it's too costly for the good guys to get in, it's not a very good system. There are also things about the curvature of the cost function that turn out to be important. There are things about the dynamics of the cost function that underlie the issues of the arms race that's inevitable, which we see these days, for instance, in CAPTCHAs, where there's a strong arms race. And we can say something systematic about that and how to anticipate and reduce the costs of that arms race. Another type of problem, getting good guys to help. This is, among other things, falls into the area known as the private provision of public goods, on which there's been theory since at least the 1950s, starting with a paper by Paul Samuelson. This, for instance, is a problem that's become really fundamental to botnets. These days, smart bots going into home computers use the CPU when utilization is low, so that the owner of the machine is unlikely to even be aware that their machine is being used. They don't know, they don't care, even aside from the fact they may not be sophisticated enough to know what to do about it, there's no reason for them particularly to care. It's not costing them very much. There are a lot of unused cycles, and that's what the bot is using. So the problem is that their machine is spamming or being used as a denial of service launch pad, hurting other people, but it's not hurting them, so they have no particular incentive to fix it. How can we get them to donate to the public good by making the effort to keep their machines patched and protect the rest of the network from their badly behaving machines? There's a long history of theory on philanthropy in economics. That all has to do with money. It's not entirely useful here, but there's a growing theory and set of results on non-monetary contribution, how to encourage people to donate to the public good, help other people with non-monetary incentives. A lot of that draws on social norm theory, social identity theory, positive self-esteem theory, optimal distinctiveness affiliation, things largely from psychology, also with some leaning on game theory. Another problem, discouraging delinquency. Oftentimes, it's okay for people to be in the system. For instance, our employees, we give them passwords. We're not trying to keep them out. But they may misbehave from time to time. We would rather they didn't do that. We want to demotivate their delinquency. Hidden action theory is useful here. The problem is that we can't directly observe what they're doing all the time. Their action is hidden, and so we can't perfectly monitor it. Hidden action theory underlies contracting theory and compensation theory, very well-developed field. Contracting theory offers a lot of advantages, for instance, in employment situations, but other theories from social psychology also help in non-employment situations, open networks, for instance. Social leaderboards, tournaments, benchmarks, dissing, various different ways of encouraging people to behave in desired ways, even if you can't directly observe it, and principles about the trade-off between the cost of monitoring imperfectly ex post and the cost of awarding them imperfectly ex post, because you don't know exactly what they did. So, summary, humans are smart devices. Of course, they're not programmable, but they do respond to design motivations, and we can use that as designers and include them in the design loop for information security. Thanks.
Straight back to the UK. I have to stay up until Saturday night.
Do you have no
acronyms
at all?
No what?
You have no PDF?
No.
No names.
Oops.
Okay.
Well, I asked to borrow a laptop.
Yes.
They gave you a laptop.
That's really good.
I'm still debugging what they thought they were doing.
Next thing you do an operating system.
Well, I actually will explain. When I went to borrow a laptop tomorrow morning,
oh,
it was
fine.
The worst day in the history of the lab to borrow a laptop. Because the night before last,
give it on
we
USB.
Broke the headquarters and stole seven laptops. And so they were desperately trying to get headquarters up. And when I went to borrow a laptop, they said, well, you're not even online. That's why the first one they gave was the I will give them some slight excuse for having a bad morning yesterday.
That's fair.
And I was talking last night about a conference full of technically minded
folks.
I always merely non-techie. So we are so meticulous about making it work. We get very worried with the slightest.
Any of you have a question while we're waiting?
Yeah, quick question.
Here we go.
What about all the Chinese folks who haven't? He's busy there.
But that question's somebody else.
Jeff?
Yes.
What about all the Chinese folks who have never patched their systems because they're dealing with pirated systems? How do they fit into your model?
Well, the short answer is we need to figure out some way to motivate them to, and just legislating it probably isn't going to be enough, but we need to think about something that they will do. I don't know much about the social responses in China, but because the culture is so different, we need to take into account culture activities. If it's that widespread problem, the motivation may be better done at the level of the ISP, for instance, and put liability on the ISP and get them to take it on as their cost by putting the risk of the burden on them.
Jeff,
how do I
get the slides on
this screen onto?
Question to Mark Levine. I wonder if the results seem to be right to me. I wonder if it would be possible to distinguish whether the mechanism is working out a social norm or working out how a number you are. So in the case where somebody's trying to fight a fight, trying to start a fight in response to 1-1-1,
yes.
If there's just one guy they're going to fight, and if it's 1-2-3, they're going to be out of the 3-1 if the fight breaks out, so not much. Whereas conversely, if it's social norm, if you've got 1-2-3,
yes,
you much greater assurance that what you're doing is outside the social norm than any one person say. I don't know if you remember that screen. If you work out which of those two mechanisms it might be, what do you work?
I think it is a really good question. The 1-1-1 thing, remember, there will be lots of other people around, and I can't split the data. I haven't split the data up by whether there's one person with lots of other people not, or just only two people doing it. So it might be something like that. I mean, I think what's going on, when we've actually plotted out the sequences, we do state transition kind of stuff, what works essentially is one person goes to the perpetrator and says, calm down, calm down. One person goes to the victim and says, don't respond. And then the critical thing, normally, when there's multiple people, is what the third turn is. If it's a mutually reinforcing one, then things are likely to end non-violently. But if a bystander or a third party does something to de-escalate the bystanders, that's read by the perpetrator as kind of license to continue. So, I mean, it's a combination of those kinds of things. But, I mean, I think in general terms, in these things, non-violence is pretty much normative. I mean, I've got some data on who throws the first punch, which I might tell you about afterwards because we're doing it.
Well done.
Okay, sorry about that. Okay, so I'm Joseph Bonneau from University of Cambridge, and I do security and privacy in social networks. So I guess kind of like Dana's talk, I'll be making actually some similar points, but I have a different perspective because what I've spent a lot of my time doing the past year is hacking Facebook, hacking the other social networks, but also analyzing them, trying to look at the underlying economics, why the situation is sort of the way it is. But I'm not actually going to talk about more of the hacks and research I've done, but sort of my perspective on what social networking means for security. And social networking is kind of a broad term. I actually think social media might be a better term in that when you say social network, you mean Facebook, but I'll be arguing that I think essentially everything is turning into a social network. So I'll try and get 3 points across. The first point is I think that there's a big culture gap in how security researchers in particular think about social networks that's hurting users. So Dana said it really well that privacy is not dead. The people who use social networks, it's not that they don't care about privacy or don't care about security. But security researchers, when I talk about research, the attitude I usually get is that social networking is sort of a broken technology and it's just for teenagers and they don't really care. They don't think it's a problem that social networks are broken because social networks aren't something that hardcore privacy people want to use personally anyway. And the sort of caricaturistic view of the people who develop social networks is that they also don't care about privacy because they see it as sort of an outdated reaction to their new disruptive technology that they're delivering to the world that's really cool and useful. And privacy is getting in their way, so why should they bother with it? So neither of these things are even close to exactly true. There's been a lot of good research in the last year actually about social networking security, but I still do hear this. And there's still some signs, I think, that the networks are not taking the problem very seriously. So this is how I think sort of privacy fundamentalist people look at social networks. They say this is just a fairly boring website. The only difference between this and anything else is that you've noted who your friends are. So why should I care about this specially? But the positive view of this is that it is just a website where you add your friends, but this is really, really powerful. So this is a game that I'm playing on Facebook. And of course, in the sort of pre-social networking world, this game existed. I could have played a flash game and called all my friends on their phones and said, log in, we can all play the word game together. But it's really nice that it's all in one spot and I can play this game and the game knows who my friends are and I play against my friends. So there really are a lot of things on the web that are more fun when you're doing them with your friends. And I think sort of regardless of what you personally think about the social networking concept, the data is pretty clear that this is something that's going to stick around. So this is the exponential growth. But I think even more impressive than the exponential growth is when you break down growth by demographic. There's pretty good evidence that really in the last 6 months, Facebook is really transitioning from something that was dominated by this sort of under 30 crowd into something that a lot of older people are signing up for. And it's very, very true that they use it in different ways. So Dana talked, I think, very clearly about how it's a different technology for teenagers and for their parents, but they are both using the same platform now. Okay, so the second point I'm going to make is that people sort of underestimate what Facebook really is. What it really is sort of a re-implementation of the entire internet at this point with sort of this social context added. So the left side of this column is sort of traditional things that people like doing on the internet. And the middle column is sort of the internet way of doing them. And on the right-hand column, you say for literally everything I've listed here, Facebook has reinvented their own version of it. So they have their own markup language, their own database query language, things that have been around forever, and so security people say, why should I care if Facebook has redone it? And then on the bottom, it's applications, so sharing photos, sharing videos, blogging. Payment is the really big one now that's come out in the last month. They're really pushing the payment platform. And it's sort of unclear if it's going to catch on or not, but it could be that auctions and selling stuff online are fundamentally mediated through Facebook. So that's really the trend that Facebook is sort of a re-implementation of the internet. The big difference is that it's sort of centrally located, you have single sign-on, and it's a sort of walled proprietary environment. The only critical difference is that you have this social annotation of who's friends with whom, but I argue that this is a really, really important difference, and I wouldn't underestimate it. I think it's compelling enough for users that they would rather do almost everything in the Facebook world than in the sort of traditional internet world. And the story is not just about Facebook, it's about everything else on the web. So these are a bunch of examples of stuff that was not initially conceived to be a social application that has migrated into a social application. So Flickr used to just be a fairly static site where you went and uploaded your photos and anybody could come along and browse them, and now there's a fairly rich social aspect to it that Flickr knows who's friends with who. Other things like blogging have migrated into sort of a social paradigm. And Windows Live Spaces is a really kind of interesting one because it was initially an email service that sort of migrated into social networking land with not all that successfully, but the trend is certainly that everybody who's doing anything on the internet is trying to turn it into a social application. Okay, so that's sort of my main argument, that everything on the internet is becoming social. The social networking paradigm is taking over. So as security people, I think we really need to think about what's different about security when you have social context. So on one hand, social networks are really just repeating everything that we've seen in the last 10 years on the internet. They have scams, phishing, all this stuff that we've been talking about in the last day. Privacy is sort of raises a lot of new issues on social networking, but essentially it's similar to issues that sort of this community has been talking about for 20 years. So I guess my challenge is to think about what the key differences of social context are for all of these types of scams. And I'll try and show a few examples. So phishing, probably five different speakers talked about phishing yesterday, and it was always in the context of bank phishing. But phishing happens on Facebook too. And the sort of user mental model when phishing happens on Facebook isn't that my bank is asking me to log in, it's this friend has sent me this message. This is a real one that I actually got. Somebody, it says, nice ass, why would you put it on the internet? And it looks exactly like a message from Facebook. If a friend tags a photo of you, you get this message, and then you say, oh, I'm going to go see the photo that my friend tagged. So when I see this, I say, that's kind of suspicious. Is there an indecent photo of me on the web? I better go check that out. And then I'm phished. So, I mean, in some ways, it's like the bank example, but the sort of transaction that the user's making in their head is very different, and this idea of maybe having protected links that know when you're accessing to the one bank you're supposed to talk to, it's not as clear that that's going to work in this scenario. So scams, when you actually do phish an account, the way that you cash this out, this has sort of been the paradigm that's come up. So in this case, Calvin is really not Calvin, it's somebody who's hacked into Calvin's account. But given that on Facebook you can sort of communicate socially and impersonate people, this is the way the scam goes down. Calvin starts talking to Evan, who's some friend of his, and he tells him this fairly compelling story that I'm lost in London, I got robbed, I don't have my credit card. And Evan says, oh, this is terrible, I want to help my friend, what can I do? And he says, well, can you send me the money via Western Union? Which is, in fact, maybe what Calvin would be asking for if he was in this situation, lost in London. But it's hard for Evan to analyze this. So we've been seeing this scam a lot, and I think in a lot of ways it's more sophisticated than the sort of classic 419 scam where you asked for money to save the Prince of Nigeria or whatever it is. So this is something that security people will have to think about. How do we deal with this type of thing? And finally, the sort of interesting thing, so users have to make these decisions, do I want to authorize this application to see my data? And this is, again, something we've seen forever, that you give users this big warning, are you sure you want to do this? The big difference here, if you look carefully, it says, do you want Scramble, which is a game, to access your profile information and your friend's information? So the difference is that now you're making this decision not only for yourself, but you're making it for your friends, because you have access to their information, too. So to wrap up, and kind of in line with what both of the last two speakers said, I think that there's good and bad aspects of social networking in terms of what it can do for security. The bad things is that the social context makes a lot of things more effective. So these phishing and scams, it's sort of, it's easier to get people to believe them with this sort of social atmosphere. It's also problematic just because it's really dynamic. It changes a lot. It's noisy. People use them really quickly, and they aren't thinking when they use them. So it's harder to get people to think really hard, like maybe they would with a bank when they're interacting with Facebook. That being said, I also think that there's some really positive things that we can do if we take advantage of the fact that there's social context on the web. So we can really use the social graph to search for anomalous behavior and fraud and maybe use that to detect things that we couldn't do previously. And I think that social connections can be really useful in giving users more trust. So we've sort of seen this previously with reputation systems, and I think we're seeing interesting applications, like yesterday, the proposal to do backup authentication using friends vouching for you. And finally, I think there's sort of a compelling thing that if friends' accounts get compromised, their friends can sort of report this because they see, oh, Calvin's account looks like it got compromised. I should report that to Facebook because I can see that Calvin wouldn't be doing this. So that's it. Thanks.
Question for Terry. Would you expand a little bit more about what you said at the very end about deliberate misuse, which I would call overreaction? It seems to me that there may be a disconnect between nature and human beings on that. So in the case you used about the anthrax attack, but human beings did say this is a novel event, to use what Dominic said yesterday, and therefore I must spend $6 billion trying to stop people from sending anthrax through the mail. But nature would not react to a novel event.
That's right.
It reacts to sustained change. So it would say, okay, well, maybe something has changed, I better watch for it, and then if it keeps up, then I'll do something. So in some respects, human beings are not natural in that sense.
Well, we try to pretend they're not, but the fact is they are, and that causes that anomalous reaction. The thing is that the event you're talking about in the case when an event actually happened, as opposed to you're trying to develop a response to respond more effectively in the future. So when you get something that's apparently or perceived as catastrophic and it's actually happened, then I think that is a natural reaction to what we saw. But in the natural world, or if you look back over history of evolution, I mean, you could argue that the last administration's response was anomalous if you look back, I think it's pretty clear when you look at non-human species that the adaptation is developed over a very long term. You know, you're talking about hundreds of years. And human interactions, human reactions in a very short time period are not necessarily going to continue to be carried out in that way. And I think, though, you know, already there is reaction to spending $6.5 billion. Actually, it's more than that. You could actually add up more.
That's just the post office.
Yeah, that's the post office. But there has been a rebalancing. And all I'm saying, you know, in our argument, in our book, in some of the chapters, is that we should, as we look back at biological evolution, the lesson is you need to take a holistic approach to risk assessment, and that investing an enormous amount of resources against one particular type of risk reveals vulnerabilities elsewhere. In this particular case, it made the United States weaker against the naturally occurring events, which are more frequent, and could cause greater casualties, in fact. And so that's a lesson I would draw from it, anyway.
Okay. I guess, Diana, a comment on Joe's talk. Another use for social networks and insecurity is actually, bad guys have friends, too. So Mark Seidman at Yahoo has talked about using basically tracking COVID-19 scammers by looking at them and looking at their IM buddy lists and actually finding their victims by looking at their behavior on social networks. So it might be possible to do interesting things with that on Facebook and other places.
Yeah, it's don't have much to add to that, but I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think that there are a lot of creative applications that we'll come up with in the next year, hopefully.
Okay, I'll just
outdated phrasing.
Terrence, I'm a little bit confused about how the notion of adaptation is working in these contexts. And biologically, a trait is adaptive if and only it contributes to the replication of an organism's genes. So it's beneficial to the entire lineage, but not necessarily to a specific organism or a population of organisms. And in fact, it can go the opposite way. Adaptive traits can be really destructive to individuals and yet benefit the reproductive success of those individuals. Whereas it seems to me when we're dealing with security, it's not quite working that way. So I wonder if you've given so many thoughts of just how the adaptation analogy is working in the domains here where we're trying to apply.
That's a really, really good question. Let me see if I can try some sort of answer to it. Maybe I haven't grasped the point quite, but if you look back in the at biological organisms, and I think the cicada example is an interesting one. So it's not just, it's having an impact on the whole species. So their evolutionary answer to dealing with risk is hiding underground for several years at different periods. And so there you have an example that there's a collective evolutionary response, which is to do with genetic development and so on. And I think there's all we're trying to say is we're not trying to mimic that, but trying to say, well, there's a lesson from this strategic. It's a fascinating strategic development, and I think that's something that could, all we're saying, that's something you could think about in the human world and in shorter time spans in order to respond. So I think that's a lesson I've drawn. Have I answered your question?
Yeah, partially. So I think then what the concern is, I think it might be sort of not entirely right to, I think the term adaptation might be misleading.
Okay.
I mean, what you're considering are the forms of certain evolutionary strategies, some of which might have analogs in the cases of the human systems that we're concerned with.
Mm-hmm. I would still say that's adaptation, but...
it's a subset of adaptation.
Yeah. Thank you.
So, Andrew, did you want to respond to that?
Yes, well, another comment. So I think a key element in security systems is that you have intelligent agents involved, whereas in biology it's mostly kind of random mutations or other things. There's a certain amount of learning, but much smaller than in this human society. In case of security, it's not as bad, but actually a really extreme example is if you look at the current or recent financial crisis, what really happens there, you have this dialogue between, say, the banks packaging the toxic securities and the rating agencies. Basically, the banks would go to that rating agency and say, how much sludge will you let us put into this particular security to still get a AAA rating? And it would get an answer and go back. And so in security context, it would be like the antivirus companies telling the virus writers, okay, here's how we're going to react if you do such and such. That doesn't work very well, obviously.
If I might respond, although the case can be made that learning has a real important formal similarity to selection, and that involves the replication of useful solutions.
It means
so we might assume it under a broader notion of selection.
Yes, but on a different time scale.
Absolutely.
But, sorry.
This panel is a sort of really interesting antidote to John's talk yesterday. Maybe we're not all that screwed because people seem to do a good job in the long run. and I'd love to hear Dana's response to some of what John is talking about in terms of how widespread and how resilient are the populations, especially the populations that have grown up, the digital natives. How resilient do you think they'll be to widespread fraud? Is this going to be something that's low-level manageable, or is this going to be something that's going to ultimately break the system?
You know, it's really hard to tell. The thing that's tricky in watching a lot of these folks go up is that, they're definitely susceptible to it. And the same probabilities as a lot of other populations. So they don't know the system. There's always this assumption that they're digital natives. This is bullshit. Most websites. They get to websites by going to the Google search bar, typing in Facebook, and clicking on it. So their reliance, on Google, and it almost always is Google, to be accurate in getting them to the right place is huge, which means that they're really vulnerable to a whole variety of things. They don't check links. They don't know this stuff. It's also not clear that they care right now. The key is what's going to happen when financial assets are on the table. For teenagers, financial assets aren't on the table. They lose their passwords more often than it's stolen from them. When you look at phishing scams with teenagers, they're susceptible to it all over the place. And they just think they blame the system. So what ends up happening is that they leave the system. So the system loses to it. Already you're seeing it across the complaints with Facebook with teenagers. It's already been huge within MySpace, which is just like, ugh, you know, Facebook is turning into MySpace. It's just, there's all this spam on my wall, right? They don't read the messages. They don't read the warnings. They're like other users in that way.
Yeah, the thing I'd add is that the concept that people understand, I sort of spend probably an hour a day looking at Facebook's privacy settings, and I don't understand how they work. there's fundamentally no mapping that's clear. The way that when I write papers about how they work, the only way to ever figure out how they work is to create two accounts, set them differently.
But that was those experiments.
The one other comment to this is that the one thing that's saving the ass of many teenagers is the fact that they're terrified of the parents, which means that they put unbelievable amounts of inaccurate information that becomes not searchable. That they lock things down to block out their parents and college admissions officers and other such people that hold power over them, and in the process block out other people. So that's the only thing that saves that group more than other things. And the other thing is they jump these systems extremely fast. They're not on that long.
So they sort of build their own security protocol on top of the broken one implemented by the network that they don't know how to use.
So the question I have for Dana, related to this is, to what extent have you been researching sort of the mental models that the teenagers actually have around, let's call it trust boundaries, friends of friends, close friends, best friends, family, etc. And do you have a good model for that? And then the other part of the question is, you know, to what extent do these systems actually represent these conceptual trust boundaries with the one-to-one mapping to what they expect?
So the answer to the second is readily. The answer to the first is a little more complicated. I am looking at a lot of their models, in particular their models of boundaries and a whole variety of different functioning forms of that. What I find that's really intriguing is that it's not so much age dependent as much as actually more than anything else socioeconomic status dependent. That plays a significant role in ways that I was not expecting when I started doing this work. And that's why I've gotten into this obsession with socioeconomic elements, which is that if you look at upper SES kids, their relationship to adults fundamentally different than lower SES kids. I'm just going to use those two caricaturizations right now, even though it's much more complex than that. Their relationship to larger extended families fundamentally different. Their relationships and the ways that they include them or don't include them in the boundary making. But more bothersome, and I'm still staring at this data and trying to work it out, their relationship to their peers is also different. The middle and upper class kids are much more likely to actually trust their peers to not backstab them than a lot of the lower SES. And I can't figure out why. I'm really battling with that data a lot. But the thing, looking at the systems, the problem with the systems is not just all of the complexities of this, but the ephemerality of a lot of these connections. The fact that these systems are absolutely incapable of managing ephemerality, the fact that you meet somebody at summer camp and they're now in your network for forever, like that's just wrong. And the ways in which you can't move seamlessly across as relationships change, as you're on the outs with your mom versus being on the ins with your mom, none of this can be managed really cleanly, and part of it is that it's the formalization of it. One of the ways, and this is critical for those who think about social networks and all of these security things, there are three critical ways to think about social networks. And I don't mean social networks as in the social network sites, I'm saying social networks. One is what the sociologists have been studying for a long time that they call personal networks. These are the people that you measure for social ties, these are all of the things that you hear about, Dunbar numbers, et cetera. The second are articulated networks. Articulated networks have a whole set of reasons of why you've chosen to articulate people, to list people off. Articulated networks are the social network sites. These are publicly articulated networks, which adds a nice spin to them. So you have to go through a formalization process and all of the politics of choosing who to publicly articulate. And the third is behavioral networks. You know, my guess is that many of you in the room don't see your mother as often as you see some of your colleagues, but you might actually trust your mother more for a whole variety of reasons, right? These three networks have some overlap with one another, but they're not the same. And so the theories around them are actually have to be determined within each structure. And the complexity of this is that we often assume a theory from sociology and just shove it into the social network sites. And that's clearly not working out. So some of it is trying to do some theory making within these particular domains.
I think we have some space to try and build the sort of sociological theory of what a social network is onto the site and have sort of a more complicated way of expressing relations to other people beyond just that person is my friend, binary yes or no.
But there's also reasons as to why we do that that are actually really critical to understand.
This is all extremely interesting, but it's past 10:30 now, so we should all talk about it during the break, I think.
I'm not going to make it.
Yeah, you should.